I want you to try and imagine, well, an almost impossible mental challenge.
Oh, I love these.
Right. So try to describe your childhood home to someone.
Mm.
But here's the thing. You have one non-negotiable condition.
Okay.
You are absolutely forbidden from using a single visual detail.
Wait, really? No.
Zero. No mentioning the color of the walls. You can't talk about the shape of the windows, no describing the architectural style or, like, the height of the ceilings.
That is, I mean, that's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, you can only rely on sensory echoes. Like, you have to describe the vibration of the floorboards when your whole family was in the kitchen.
Or maybe, I don't know, the specific hollow echo of a radio playing in the background on a Sunday morning.
Exactly. You have to strip away our primary sense completely.
Which forces you to, like, shut off your eyes and turn on a completely different kind of internal vision.
Right, because you aren't just recalling a physical building anymore.
No, you're translating pure non-visual emotion into something tangible. It demands a totally different vocabulary.
And that translation process is actually the overarching mission of our deep dive today.
Yeah, we are unpacking how an artist actually achieves this.
How they take a raw, invisible memory, something entirely untethered from physical space, and somehow metabolize it into a physical, two-dimensional piece of art.
It's fascinating. And the subject we're examining today is this incredible artwork titled Homes in Placa by the artist Jero Duque.
And we have a really robust stack of source material guiding this analysis today, which, you know, gives us a rare level of access.
We do. We're pulling from Duque's own personal notes, several revealing excerpts from his book, Trastio, Pintura Artistica.
Which is great.
Yeah, and we also have the highly detailed technical data sheet for the artwork itself.
And I think this combination of materials is ideal because it allows us to see far beyond just the surface of the canvas.
We don't just get to describe the what of the painting to you. We actually get to dissect the how and the why behind its creation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We get to track the evolution from a loose memory all the way to a finished piece. And actually, the very first thing we need to address is the physical location of the canvas itself during that creation process.
Right, because the technical data sheet completely subverts what you would, like, naturally expect from a painting like this.
For sure. When you hear about a painting that captures the essence of Placa, which is this ancient historic neighborhood in Athens, Greece, right at the foot of the Acropolis,
you immediately picture a very specific romantic ideal.
I know I do. You assume the artist is standing there with an easel en plein air, you know,
healing the Mediterranean breeze.
Yeah, painting the ruins and the winding streets in real time.
But the technical sheet gives us coordinates that are geographically and environmentally the exact opposite.
It's so wild. This painting wasn't created in Greece at all.
No, it was painted in February of 2023 inside a closed studio in Whittier, California.
Whittier, California. I mean, it's just such a contrast.
It was brought to life in this isolated laboratory environment long before it ever traveled the world for exhibitions.
Right, like it's showing at the Jonathan Schultz Gallery in Miami in April 2023.
And later at the Thompson Gallery in Zug, Switzerland in December 2024.
But its absolute genesis is a closed room in Southern California. And I have to be honest, I'm a bit of a skeptic here.
Oh, how so?
Well, doesn't being thousands of miles away in an isolated laboratory, like, dilute the authenticity of the place?
That's a really common reaction.
I mean, doesn't the artist lose the truth of Greece by sitting in a studio next to a Los Angeles suburb?
Well, this is where we encounter the central paradox of what Duque considers evocation art.
Okay, evocation art.
Yeah. You might assume that being thousands of miles away from the subject matter would dilute the truth, but in this specific process, physical distance actually acts as a purifying filter.
A purifying filter. I think I see the logic there.
Think about it. If you set up an easel right in the middle of Placa today, you aren't just painting the ink of history.
You're inevitably painting the noisy tourists asking for directions.
Exactly. You are distracted by the heat, the trash on the corner.
The immediate, overwhelming, mundane reality of a modern city.
Right. The present tense is just too loud. But sitting in a silent studio in Whittier, California, all of that anecdotal noise is entirely stripped away.
So the distance kind of runs off the trivial distractions,
leaving only the concentrated, pure emotional essence of the memory. The studio basically acts as a sensory deprivation tank for the present,
which allows the past to come into sharp focus. That is, wow, that makes perfect sense.
And because the artist is relying entirely on that internalized memory rather than the physical landscape in front of them, the actual materials they choose to paint with have to carry an immense amount of weight.
Right, they have to physically trap something as abstract as a memory. So how does he actually do that? What are the tools?
Well, this is where the alchemy of Duke's materials becomes really critical to the evolution of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't use oil or acrylic.
He uses watercolor, right?
Specifically, yes. And watercolor is notoriously unforgiving.
Yeah, I mean, with oils, if you make a mistake, you can just let it dry and scrape it off or paint right over it.
You can endlessly revise and hide your tracks.
But watercolor is entirely translucent. It demands brutal honesty from the artist.
It is a ruthless medium. Every single layer you put down permanently tells the story of the layer beneath it.
There's no hiding.
None. And because it is so demanding, the substrate, the paper itself, becomes an active participant in the artwork, not just a passive surface.
And the technical notes specify the paper, don't they?
They do. Duke uses Arches brand paper, specifically 300 gram weight, and cold pressed.
Okay, for anyone not super familiar with watercolor mechanics, that 300 gram thickness is a structural necessity.
Absolutely.
Because watercolor essentially involves orchestrating controlled puddles of water.
Right, and if you try to do that on thin paper, the moisture causes the cellulose fibers to warp and buckle.
It just destroys the integrity of the piece.
Yeah, so the 300 gram weight acts as a dense mechanical sponge that can support heavy saturation without losing its geometric shape.
But the cold press specification, I feel like that is where the texture really dictates the emotional output.
It really is. When paper is cold pressed during manufacturing, the pure cotton fibers aren't ironed completely flat.
They're left with this microscopic terrain.
Exactly, a rugged landscape of tiny microvalleys across the surface of the page. And this texture is vital when you introduce the specific pigments Duke relies on.
He uses Daniel Smith brand watercolors, right?
Yes, which are distinct in the art world for having extremely high mineral concentrations.
Some of their pigments are literally manufactured by finely grinding semi-precious stones.
Which is just incredible to think about.
So picture that physical interaction on the microscopic level.
Okay.
You have this thick, rugged terrain of paper, and the artist lays down wet wash of ground semi-precious stones.
And as the water slowly evaporates, those heavy, dense minerals physically sink.
They get trapped permanently inside the microvalleys of the cold-pressed cotton. It's an incredibly geological process.
And the result of that is, when light enters the room where the painting is hanging, it penetrates the surface.
It hits those trapped minerals inside the valleys and bounces back to the viewer,
creating this deep internal luminosity that a synthetic dye simply cannot replicate.
It honestly reminds me of a musical composer who, like, strictly refuses to use synthesizers or digital tracks.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Instead, they restrict themselves entirely to raw acoustic instruments, like maybe a cello carved from a specific resonant wood.
Or a very particular brass horn.
Yeah. They intentionally limit their tools to those organic physical materials to force the audience to feel a very resonant, specific nostalgia.
The severe limitation of the material becomes the literal conduit for emotional connection.
The chemistry of the water, the cotton paper, and the ground minerals, they are doing the heavy lifting of translating a distant memory into physical reality.
So having established that physical foundation, we really need to examine how Duke applies these materials.
What he's actually painting, step by step.
Right, because he's trying to capture what he describes in his book as a persistent sensation.
He explicitly states he is not trying to capture the geometric reality of the streets of Plaka.
Instead, his inspiration for this sensation is the vital ethos found in the book and film Zorba the Greek.
See, when you bring up Zorba the Greek, my immediate association is a very literal narrative.
Sure, you picture Anthony Quinn dancing wildly on a beach.
Exactly. It takes a moment to connect a narrative about a dancing man to a static watercolor painting of architecture.
Well, the connection isn't literal. It's entirely philosophical.
Okay, break that down for me.
The core philosophy of Zorba is the ultimate duality of the Mediterranean soul.
That profound understanding that absolute crushing tragedy and overwhelming ecstatic joy don't just exist in the same world.
They occupy the exact same moment in time.
And translating that complex philosophical duality into a visual medium, I imagine that requires intense discipline.
It does, which Duke achieves through what he terms a contained chromatic economy.
So, by severely limiting his color palette, the colors he does choose have to work exponentially harder to convey that tension.
Precisely. The painting is dominated by a sweeping, blinding white, which represents the optimistic, piercing Mediterranean light.
But he violently clashes that white against two counterforces.
Intense, vibrant red roofs and what he specifically calls structural blacks.
Now, using pure black and watercolor, that sounds like a massive technical risk. I mean, it's almost a technical sin, right?
It is often considered one, yeah. The conventional wisdom is that black muddies the transparency and kills the very luminosity we were just discussing.
But Duke isn't using black as a simple shadow cast by the sun.
No, he's using it as a physical structural skeleton to anchor the human eye.
Because if you have a composition dominated by blinding, optimistic white light, the human eye just quickly gets lost.
There are no boundaries to contain the optimism. The white only feels truly piercing because it is forced to sit directly adjacent to an area of abyssal, infinite darkness.
That visual tension, the light desperately requiring the dark to be understood, that's the visual manifestation of the tragedy and joy in Zorba.
Exactly. You cannot have the blinding joy without the heavy structural anchor of the tragedy beneath it.
And sitting between that blinding white and abyssal black are those vibrant red roofs.
Right. If white is the light and black is the structural tragedy, the red acts as the vital pulse.
It represents the visceral beating heart of the neighborhood, the human element, the clay, the heat, the passion of that Zorba ethos.
It completely prevents the painting from becoming a sterile exercise in extreme contrast.
It grounds it in the blood and life of the people who actually inhabit those spaces.
And all of this intense chromatic tension creates a deeply saturated visual experience. The architecture in the painting is overlapping, dense, and jarring.
It basically demands so much of your visual cortex that it becomes almost overwhelming.
But Duke understands this physiological toll on the viewer, which is why the treatment of the sky is so deliberate.
In his notes, he describes the sky not merely as a background element, but as a breath.
Usually the sky in an architectural painting is just the blue space behind the important subject matter.
But here, he uses a fluid wash of blue with absolutely no hard edges at the very top of the painting.
It functions as a visual silence.
If that soft, expansive breathing space wasn't there at the top of the canvas, the sheer density and chromatic tension of the houses would just visually asphyxiate the viewer.
You biologically need that breath of empty blue to process the intensity of the neighborhood below.
And man, that neighborhood below definitely defies traditional architectural rendering.
Oh, completely. Plaka is one of the oldest continually inhabited neighborhoods in the world.
It carries millennia of history. Ancient Greek, Roman, Byzantine, Ottoman, and neoclassical layers, all just built on top of each other.
If an architectural drafting teacher examined this painting, they would fail it immediately.
Yeah, the perspective is skewed. The angles don't align logically.
The buildings don't follow Euclidean geometry at all.
Because Duke didn't paint it like a photograph. As he says, he listened before he looked.
He painted the echoes of those historical layers rather than the literal street layout.
Which perfectly mirrors how human memory actually operates. Like, we don't remember spatial dimensions like a camera or a tape measure does.
No, we really don't.
If I asked you to draw your grandmother's kitchen purely from memory, you wouldn't draw it perfectly to scale.
I'd probably draw the kitchen table as this massive, looming object taking up the majority of the room.
Right, because that is where the emotional weight lived, where the conversations happened, where the family gathered.
And I'd shrink the cabinets or the hallway down to nothing because they held no emotional significance.
Exactly. Memory physically stacks and distorts space based on emotional importance.
So Duke is bending the geometry of these ancient streets to accommodate the emotional weight of his memories.
The historical gravity of Plaka is literally warping the physical structures in the painting.
And within this emotionally distorted architecture, Duke places two highly specific symbols that break whatever structural logic remains.
And these two elements represent the core existential tension of the entire work.
The first of these symbols is impossible to miss. In the immediate foreground of the painting, there is a massive tree.
But it isn't just a decorative landscape detail. The trunk of the tree literally absorbs a human silhouette.
The figure is fused completely into the wood.
And I'll admit, my initial reaction to reading that description was to view it through a lens of dark mythology.
Like a punishment.
Yeah, something akin to the myth of Daphne, who was transformed into a laurel tree to escape Apollo, but was then trapped forever in a vegetative state.
Right, seeing a human absorbed by a tree evokes a sense of being held hostage by your environment.
A kind of cultural asphyxiation. But that's not what Duke intended, is it?
No, it's not. While that interpretation of entrapment is common when we see humanity swallowed by nature, Duke's personal notes explicitly counter it.
Okay, so how does he reframe it?
He reframes this fusion of human and tree as a conscious self-criticism. For Duke, this is not a depiction of being trapped.
It is the ultimate expression of belonging.
He is illustrating the concept of putting down roots.
So the figure isn't a prisoner of the tree. The figure is actively rooting into the territory.
By fusing with the bark and the soil, the human is feeding on the exact same ancient history as the landscape itself.
It totally erases the boundary between the individual and the thousands of years of culture they emerge from.
They are fiercely and permanently anchored to their origins.
But a painting that solely depicts heavy, unmoving stillness and rootedness, that would be philosophically incomplete.
It requires a counterbalance.
And to provide that contrast to the immense stillness of the foreground tree, Duke paints staircases in the background.
Populated by small, traversing figures moving along them.
Geographically, staircases are a physical necessity in Plaka.
Because the neighborhood is built into the steep, rocky hillside of the Acropolis, you need stairs just to navigate from one street to another.
So they are geographically accurate, but their purpose in the composition is highly symbolic.
They provide crucial vertical dynamism. While the tree anchors you deeply into the ground, the stairs represent what is classically known as the vital path.
They embody humanity's constant biological drive to move upward and forward through time.
It is the refusal to just sit still, root into the ground, and mourn the ancient ruins.
The figures on the stairs are exploring, advancing, and pushing the culture into the future.
When you pull these threads together, the synthesis of the human experience in this single watercolor is profound.
It really is. You have this sweeping existential dualism playing out through the chemistry of the paint.
On one hand, you have the deep, intrinsic human need to plant roots, to find a permanent refuge.
To belong so deeply to a cultural history that you literally become the tree in the foreground.
And simultaneously, pulling in the exact opposite direction, you have the staircases.
The relentless biological imperative to ascend, to explore, and to refuse stagnation.
Duke manages to capture that entire epic human struggle, the tension between where we come from and where we are going.
Not by rendering every brick with photographic precision, but by suggesting it through color limitation, heavy mineral texture, and emotionally distorted space.
It proves that sometimes the most accurate way to document a space isn't by standing right in front of it with a camera or a tape measure.
Sometimes the truest way to capture a place is to lock yourself in a studio thousands of miles away in California.
Let your memory metabolize the reality over time.
And trust the physical friction of water, thick cotton paper, and ground up stones to tell the truth.
It is a masterful alignment of a highly controlled, demanding physical process with an entirely unrestrained emotional truth.
As we wrap up our deep dive into Holmes and Plaka, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, returning to that mental challenge we opened with.
Oh, yeah.
If you were locked in a silent studio tomorrow, completely isolated from your past, handed thick, rugged paper and rich mineral pigments. Well, and you were tasked with painting your own childhood home based only on the emotional weight of your memories.
That's a profound challenge.
What parts of the architecture would you deliberately distort to make it feel more real? And what secret figure would you hide in the landscape to prove that you still belong there?